from the pestiferous studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another lantern bashing hour of chemical free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. You don't hear much about the spotted lantern fly these days, but that doesn't mean they're gone. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll reveal new research identifying their natural enemies. Plus, we'll examine methods of farming around the world that could improve our farms and gardens. And your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and obviously opinionated orations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you recruiting spine soldier bugs to play defense.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the rapidly recovering studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another resurrected hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we report on a story of rosy rebound by writer Mike Newell that originally appeared in a recent edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we quote, last spring, when the famous Taos Machin rose bloomed only a handful of delicate pink flowers, Kim Staub, executive director of the Wick Historic House and Garden in Germantown, was not worried because the summer before, a poacher had climbed into the museum's enclosed garden and, using dull pruners, clipped off nearly all of the plant's living material. The iconic rosebush has long been a draw at the Wick Historic House and Garden. Celebrated for its beauty, the giant rose fans out dramatically over the colonial home's entrance, drawing visitors to the historic house and their gardens. And when the poacher made off with its shoots, the Talmachin's caretakers knew that their prize could take several years to recover. This May, when the Talmachin revealed countless clusters of tiny pink flowers, Straub truly understood the meaning of its name, A Thousand Beauties. Taking on a second life, the climbing rose exploded with new pink blooms. In fact, its ruffled flowers grew so strong that horticulturalists at the Wick now hope it will bloom again later this summer, something it did not do last year after its mauling. It was first planted around 1910 by Jane Bone Haynes, a descendant of the Wistar Haynes family, which maintained the house for 9 generations. Bone Haynes was a Quaker educational reformer who founded the Pennsylvania Horticultural School for Women on what is now the site of Temple University's Ambler campus and is still devoted to horticulture. Conceived to be the oldest rose garden in America in its original plan, some of the plants at the Wick have remained in the same location since 1821. Although not the oldest, the dramatic Talmachin is the best known. Staff suspect that the poacher clumsily clipped the rose in 2023 to either grow the shoots at their own home or sell them online. No one was ever arrested. Gardeners at the Wick slowly nursed the plant back to health, a process that drew new members and supporters to the Wick, said Straub. Straub says 2 years later, we still get which is the rose that was vandalized, which was the one that was torn to shreds, and they're really surprised to see it doing so well. The plant's revival comes as the National Historic Landmark undertakes a long-planned exterior restoration. As part of the project, gardeners will delicately unwind the Taos Machine's branches from its trellis and pull them away from the area to be repaired before retying them. Despite the positive plant prognosis, it could still take 5 years before the Taos Machine regrows to its full former size, says Jackson Warren, manager of living collections at the WIC. That's how much woody growth was stolen. But Warren is confident that the Taos Machine is up to the task. As Warren explains, these plants are part of our history, and they want to continue to be here, adding to that legacy over and over again.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in just a little bit, excellent good news about the spotted lanternfly. But first, one of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Stephen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. How are you and Ducky today?
We are, I can't say we're ducky. As we record this, we're in the middle of a 100-degree-a-day heat wave, and Ducky's pond has dried up, and he's been relegated to the bathtub.
He's sad then.
Yeah. But he'll get his water back. He'll be outside playing in his duck pool soon enough.
Sure he will. Well, you're getting hit a little worse than we are if you're getting 100 degrees.
Oh, yeah. Where are you?
In Missouri, northern Missouri.
Yes.
About an hour north of Kansas City.
Yes. You're supposed to be hotter than we are at this time of year. And I've been to Missouri in August, and it is no pleasure, believe me. But now that the world has turned upside down, right now, again, as we record this, Philadelphia, Boston, New York are all breaking records. They're shattered. We have had daytime temperatures of 100 degrees. So with the humidity, that's like feels like 110. And we had such a cool spring. We are just racked. It's like being run over twice.
I know. We had a wonderful spring, too, but it looks like summer is upon us for sure. And I say Missouri can be very, very humid and nasty during the summer.
Missouri, despite other states and locales claiming the distinction, is the most humid place I have ever visited. It was air you can wear.
Yeah. I've never heard that. That's a good one. Air you can wear. I'll have to remember that.
Yeah. All you got to do is visit St. Louis in August, and you'll never forget it.
True, very true.
All right. What can we do you for?
Well, I heard one of your shows, I think, last week I was listening to it, and you talked a little bit about poison ivy.
Right.
And it reminded me of way back in the dawn of creation around 1970 and 75. That was back when, I'm sure you might remember, when a telephone was connected to the wall. You didn't just pick it up and carry it around.
Absolutely, with a rotary dial.
Anyway, I worked for a company by the name of Southwestern Bell at the time.
Okay.
Which is now AT&T. But anyway, I was a telephone man going around installing phones, which required a lot of pole climbing. And as we all know, Poison Ivy loves poles.
Yeah.
The company would give us a product called Immunivy.
Huh.
And it came in four small vials, a little pack, kind of like a Band-Aid package.
Right.
And there was little popper packs in it. They were about 1 to 1.5 cc. The only ingredient said was poison ivy extract.
Huh.
But you would take one a month. I would take two because of my susceptibility. And just put it in water, mix it up, and drink it. And it tasted just like tea, which was kind of surprising with poison ivy being something that's pretty ugly to me.
Wow, I have never heard about immunizing yourself against poison ivy by taking a pill. What was the name of this again?
Okay, this was a liquid, and it was Immunivy,
right.
Regular immune, with the word ivy after it. And it was a liquid extract. I assume they had to squeeze it, mash it out of there somehow. And I always thought it would be around, never thought anything about it. And actually, I took a pack to the doctor I was going through at that time, and he looked at it, kind of shook his head. He said, well, I've never heard of it. But, I mean, I swore by it because, as I say, I was so allergic to it, I could just about look at a picture and break out with rash.
Yeah, so. I know people like you. No, so I was wrong. It's not a pill. These were liquid capsules that you broke up and put in water, right?
Yeah, yes, correct.
Do you think it's still around?
No, I recently here got on and looked around on the Internet. I never, ever saw one single mention of it anywhere. I don't know if that time, if the CDC or AMA, whoever found out about it, you know, and I don't know if some corporation squelched it. I also looked up how many millions of dollars are spent on poison ivy.
Oh, Lord.
And yes, and it is in the millions plus, and, you know, around the world it's going to be billions. So maybe somebody didn't want it around, because it was too good to be true.
And there's no chance you have an old package laying around.
No, I sure wish I did. And I thought about that. I keep little trinkets and stuff like that, but I certainly don't have one. Like I said, I never thought that it would be taken away. So, you know, I didn't pay special attention to keeping any.
It might have been as simple as the manufacturer deciding it wasn't cost effective to pay to be registered with the FDA.
Hmm.
But it makes total sense to me. Allergists, for instance, will inject people with reduced amounts, almost homeopathic amounts, of the thing they're allergic to, and you get your allergy shots, I don't know, once a month or something like that. And
okay.
Your system, because it's such a low dose, kind of builds up an immunity, but more realistically, it gets used to it.
Okay.
And it doesn't identify the allergen as an invader, because
uh-huh.
I've got this stuff in my system already. It must be normal. But I've never heard of taking it orally. This is a fascinating phone call, man. I am so happy you called.
Well, yeah, I enjoyed it. Like, I listen to the show every time I get a chance, and I enjoyed that, and it piqued my interest. And I thought, well, and I've never heard anyone talk about it. I've never heard, you know, other than the other installers I work with, I don't know of anyone who else who ever had tried or heard of it themselves. But like I say, I swore by, I don't know what I would have done if I had not had it, because there was times, you know, when a pole was just covered.
Oh, yeah.
Poison ivy, and I had to eventually climb the pole. As you know, there's no way to completely 100% not get any on you.
Yeah.
And I was reading, even the roots and the stem and everything else contains that, you'll probably know how to pronounce it, it's a urushiol oil.
I think
something.
You pronounced it better than I do. And yes, a good thing we mentioned that, because you can kill the plant with repeated doses of herbicide, but the dead plant is still highly allergic. So all you did is dry it out and probably gave yourself a false sense of security.
Yes. And I didn't know until, well, one of our friends had burnt some. It was on the wall.
Oh, that's the worst.
Oh, my. And I guess the smoke out of the stove got on her face.
Oh, yeah. No, people have died when poison ivy was burned in massive quantities. The actual allergen gets in your lungs.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
What I saw said our system sees it as a foreign allergen or whatever, and it overreacts, is what I saw. It says our system overreacts to it, which, and is by this, all the things it does, depending on allergen, if it's sniffing or running nose, you know, things like that, it's trying to get rid of it. But with poison ivy, it's not doing very good.
Yeah, and I don't understand the rationale, the natural rationale between contact allergies where you break out in a rash. I mean, that's not your body trying to expel something. It's just punishing you for not counting the leaves.
Yeah, that's true. There's so many myths about it, as though if you scratch it, it'll spread, and that's not true. And I remember as a child, I had it all over my face.
Oh.
We didn't have air conditioning, so I sat in front of a box fan with calamine lotion all over my face, and them saying, don't scratch it, you'll spread it.
Yeah. Well, no, you won't spread it, and it's not contagious, but you'll make your skin situation much worse if you do scratch it. What's this song? You're my age. You're going to need an ocean of calamine lotion.
Poison. Yes, I remember that was about a lady, I believe, named Poison Ivy.
All right, man. Well, we got to go right now, but I have written all this down, and I am going to try to find this or what happened to it. So stay tuned.
I got you. If you do find anything, I hope, please put it on your show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Yeah, thanks. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
As well, too, here you have a nice warm day.
That's mean. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there what is growing garlic that harvest time is here. Wait until the bottom third of your plants are brown and pull them up. The brownest first, the greenest last. But don't go assessing your alliums just yet, because we'll be right back with inspiration from the third world on restoring our broken farming and gardening systems, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8000. 8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's been about 10 years since the spotted lanternfly invaded our country. And we haven't talked about it much lately. But in the last 5 years, some amazing discoveries have been made that show we have a lot of beneficial insects, birds, arthropods that prey on these creatures, and that if we leave well enough alone, they may settle back into the natural order of predator versus prey with pest in the middle. And that's coming up along with your fabulous phone calls. But I can think of no better way to introduce my guest, Kelsey Timmerman, author of the new book, Regenerating Earth, Farmers Working with Nature to Feed Our Future, just out from Patagonia Publishing, and then to start out with how things are so much better sometimes when we leave them alone and let nature figure it out.
Oh, yeah. So that is kind of this premise of rewilding, right? Regenerative agriculture is kind of involves a belief that human involvement can help undo some of the damage that humans have done.
And your book reminds me, and this is a compliment, of the book that started the organic gardening movement in America, which is An Agricultural Testament by Sir Albert Howard. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am. I know the Rodales were very much inspired by Sir Albert Howard's work.
Right. Briefly, he was sent to India to reform their, quote, primitive method of agriculture, and was there for a while and realized, wait a minute, they're doing this much better and smarter than we are, and disappointed the people who had sent him, but created a fervor very early on that led a lot of people to try and reject agricultural chemicals and methods and look at using natural materials to build up the soil again.
Yeah, and those practices that he used are the ones that many regenerative farmers are using today. So the Rodales, through their magazine, which I saw and heard referenced by many farmers here in the United States, that was kind of their introduction to more of an organic or regenerative practice. They were inspired by Sir Albert Howard's work. And some of that I think people forget, because often now when we talk about regenerative agriculture, we're often left pictures and voices of kind of Midwest American white farmers, which I'm surrounded by here in Indiana.
I'll send a car to get you out.
Oh, I love it here. Don't do that. I love it here. It's the place where I'm planting my roots, Mike.
So it's funny you mention OG, because Sir Albert Howard's book was the direct inspiration for J.I. Rodale to begin this new publication called Organic Farming and Gardening, right around like 39, 1940, something like that. Matter of fact, he hired Sir Albert Howard to be an advisor for the magazine. That's when the magazine was all about composting, which interestingly enough was called layering back then, essentially collecting everything on your landscape and turning it back into soil. But Sir Albert was the reason organic gardening existed in America, including the phrase.
Yeah, I'm learning stuff. You know, regenerative agriculture is not a new and exciting thing, as like sometimes we're left to believe that. If your listeners have heard the word, seen some of the documentaries that are out, I call it, it's an old and exciting thing. It's something that indigenous cultures and traditional communities have been using for millennia, really, to live in relationship with the landscape and with the natural world.
And then marketing came in, and we had to find a use for all the explosives left over and deadly chemicals after World War II. And it's funny how all of these nasty things very quickly find their way into agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, weapons of war. You know, if it means side, it means to kill something. Tractors, pretty much the tank factories converted to tractor factories. And so people where I live were able to farm much larger swaths of land with less labor. And really, in the beginning, I don't think you can blame them. One of the farmers I talked with, Will Harris at White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia, said that his father was on the farm and the fertilizer salesman came up and said, dump this on your grass. And they were in cattle, so grass equals money.
Right.
And so he dumped it on his grass. I come back and look a couple more days and see what it looks like. Well, boy, howdy, the grass grew a lot, right? And so I'm going to use this everywhere. And you can't, they didn't know the negative repercussions of stepping onto this treadmill of fertilizer and then eventually into insecticides and pesticides and things like that.
And what's disappointing to me is this sequence of events immediately follows the Dust Bowl, which means sometimes we seem incapable of acquiring knowledge.
Yeah, like we don't learn our lessons there at all. I feel like what's remarkable are the farmers who tried out the fertilizer, tried out the chemicals that worked the first time they used it, and they, you know, there was no negative repercussions of them as far as they knew, and they rejected them because it felt like unnatural to them in some way. And I think that's really phenomenal that those farmers, you know, maybe they were hearing the echoes of the Dust Bowl and were thinking about what life is in my soil.
One of the things you mention in your book is this concept, this mental image of a farmer, instead of riding a tractor down his fields, suddenly being like one of the Martian war machines in War of the Worlds. He's up in this isolated, air-conditioned machine with satellite radio and GPS. And both literally and figuratively, he has removed himself from the land. There's no concept of the land. And I wonder if sometimes they don't act like they're on a production line instead of raising food.
So I have friends and family that's the type of agriculture they do. And I don't think that they know any different. Many of them were born into the system. It was handed down to them. And I rode with one of my buddies in a, you know, satellite driven tractor where he would just get to the end of the row and have to turn it. And the computer was controlling how much of seeds to put in certain areas. And it was and then also how much fertilizer to squirt on it right then and there. And the prescription for that came from the agrochemical company.
Of course.
And so there are farmers now that are starting to question this relationship. One of my buddies put it, farmers are being farmed by these giant agrochemical companies, and now they're seeing their land degrade, and the cost of these inputs have gone up, and the value of their crops have gone down.
Now, as I referred to earlier, your book is not a new concept. It's a concept that has been, except for a small circle of friends, as Phil Oakes might say, forgotten, or it's been made fun of, or it's only used in like boutique farming. And you and I both know that that's not the case. And one reason I wanted you on the show, it is important to remind people of these things that we've forgotten, that have been brushed aside in the name of efficiency. I don't know how old you are, but back in the 50s, the big thing with satirists was beware the efficiency expert. Boy, I don't think that's ever been more true.
Yeah, our system now is not resilient. And I think really what I'm trying to get at this book is the loss of connection that we've had to the land, whether a farmer's farming thousands of acres or not really having to know the land because they're going to get a prescription from the agrochemical company, and connection from one another. You know, there are fewer farmers all the time. Farms are just getting bigger, and farmers have to, they don't have to rely on each other so much. So I was kind of experimenting with some of these concepts on my own, 20 acres here and have a pasture. And I was meeting all my neighbors because my darn sheep would get out and be munching in their yard. But it was kind of fun, this connecting of like, they would get to, they've not been around sheep that much, and they would get that experience, and they would kind of talk fondly about it. And then, so I did meet more of my neighbors because my livestock kept getting out. So the county's worst shepherd.
That's how I met some of my neighbors. I live out in a rural area, and we had only been there about a year when I was coming home from a restaurant, and there was a horse in the middle of the road. And I stopped my car, put my flashers on, and saw immediately the barn where the horse had come from, and just took him gently by the bridle, walked him back to his stable, where he seemed to relax quite a bit. I gave him some food. I made sure his water was fresh, and drove home and thought, so this is my life now. This is pretty cool.
That's great. Well, you're a good neighbor. Come move by me, Mike, anytime. I'll get some more sheep, and you can return them for me. But, you know, there's that connection with animals. They connect you with the place more. Like when I was rotationally grazing my sheep around, had through this, like, mesh netting, I started to learn more of kind of what plants were in my pasture, and then all of the deadly poisonous plants that are in there too, that I first thought, oh, I need to take all these down. But the sheep, they come built with instructions of not to eat that stuff,
yeah.
Right? They just know. So you see the wisdom in the sheep. The chickens kind of help you know and connect more with, like, when the sun sets. This time of year, it's like, just go to bed already so I can shut the door, you know?
Uh-huh. Every morning, if I wake up, and it's that hour before dawn and daylight, I'll just listen. And if I hear the birds, I'll go, oh, it's almost dawn.
Yeah. They have a built-in alarm. All right. So we've become disconnected from this relationship with animals, this relationship with the land. And at a time where many in our society are more lonely than ever, especially people in rural communities, this is a solution not just for our environment, not just for our air and our rivers, but for us to feel more connected and like we're contributing more in our world.
I have felt by relying, I learned to garden from Organic Gardening magazine and an old Johnny Selected seed catalog. And so I was composting before I was growing. I was using raised beds, and sometimes you fall into a rote and you don't think about it very much, but I often realize, which is good, how lucky I am to know the soil so well, and I really don't concentrate on my plants as much as I concentrate on my soil, because they talk about you can live X number of minutes without oxygen, you can live X number of days without water. I mean, we need soil. And right now, it is difficult to turn the battleship around, to get people to accept that this way is essentially killing us and feeding us very low nutrition food. And I don't expect everybody to go out and have a backyard garden or join a community garden or work on a small farm. But I will tell you, those that do are going to feel better and be better people.
Yeah, I mean, even if it's even if you live in the city and have a little porch that you could grow a tomato plant on, just like to experience the miracle of a seed. You know, like for me, like a sunflower seed blows my mind, right? One seed, it can produce something that's taller than me that has 1,000 other seeds. Like, how is the world not just one giant sunflower patch?
Exactly.
I don't know. Yeah, there's so much abundance. But also, if people don't have the opportunity or the space to use these farming practices, you can still connect with nature. Like, what is your favorite tree? have a favorite tree, like see a place, you know, in all four seasons and get to know it. As one native Hawaiian cultural practitioner told me, like they're relearning some of aspects of their culture, and he's very engaged in teaching the younger generation. So one of the questions he asked them is, what river do you belong to?
Ha!
And so I bet you know, Mike, what river do you belong to?
Delaware.
There you go. I belong to the Mississinewa. And then accept that reciprocity with that river and the responsibility, and maybe get engaged with it or go visit it every once in a while or paddle down it. Like, these are ways that we can become kind of champions for regenerative agriculture. And also, you know, we can buy regenerative products as well.
Yeah, when I was growing up, I didn't realize how lucky I was, but our land used to belong to the Lenni Lenape, and there were still all sorts of fragments of their culture. And there was a stream in Pennypack Park that appeared to be almost primeval, that appeared to be whatever spirits they had left inhabited the water, because I agree with your friend, what water is your neighbor? What water are you bound to?
Yeah, I mean, everything we dump on the ground eventually ends up in the river, and it brings life and it kind of takes it away. Like, and also this as a metaphor, I think it works really well about like those who came before us, you know, we're living with the decisions that they made, and those who come after us, they're downstream, which is where I live. It's the Miamiaki, the Miami tribe.
Right.
And Miamiaki means downstream people. And so like the decisions that we make impacts the lives of people in the future. And I think that's really important to remember that we're part of this flow of sins and good decisions as well.
Yeah, if you're upstream, whether in water reality or as a metaphor, you don't see the damage you're doing downstream where all your mistakes go.
Yeah, one of the things I did, so this book is about, you know, agriculture. I traveled around the world to meet farmers and learn from their practices, but it ended up becoming something so much more. And one of the ways I wanted to get to know my river was I paddled for 3 days down the Mississinewa River, which really no one ever does, these parts of this river. And I went to a place called the Seven Pillars, which was sacred to the Miami. And mm-hmm. I'm just still learning of what that relationship was like and is like with the land. And many of us have kind of been uprooted. Now we're just settled into a place, and to get to know a place takes some effort, as any relationship does.
Your book is largely a travelogue recounting your adventures, learning about ancient cultures and original forms of real agriculture, meaning people growing plants. I need you to pick one story that is the one that still, even after writing the book, stands out to you.
Yeah, I think my time with the Arhuaco in Colombia, an indigenous group that lives in the Sierra Nevada, the Santa Marta Mountains in northern Colombia, you know, they're really unique. They have really retained so much of their cultural, even their dress. They wear like this a white cone-shaped hat that's the shape of the mountains. And they sew all their own, like, white tunics. And they believe that they were placed on this earth to care for this area, which they call the heart of the world. And they're basically organic, fair trade, whatever term you want to put on it, by culture. But they believe that they were put here to take care of this place, and they pray for the world. And they think that if anything happens negatively in their place, it could impact the entire world. And I think that's a really important lesson for all of us, that we need to act where we live has such importance, and that we, that relationship with that place has such importance, that wherever you live is the heart of the world that you should take care of for the rest of us.
If that spread out from everybody, we'd live in Eden. So one last question, and this is the hardest one. How do we turn this battleship around? Because, you know, we'd be fighting a war against big business to make these changes. Not only people's hearts and minds, but a lot of people who have merchandised these things that have taken us out of the natural world, but they want to protect their investments. How are we going to cause change?
One of the places that gives me hope was in Hawaii, where there was corn on the island of Kauai. And I'm like, corn's supposed to be from Indiana, right? And so there was corn, and they could grow three seasons of corn, and the agrochemical companies were doing, you know, new varieties and new chemical compounds, and some of these were taking place next to school, and they could have three growing seasons. So it was even more chemicals going, and that the community just was like, what's being sprayed? When is it being sprayed? And the agrochemical companies would not tell them. Well, this community rose up, and they demanded, and through legal process, kind of won and lost and won, and ultimately won because those companies now have decreased their footprint on the island of Kauai by about 50%. So community action can make a difference, but we also need to support regenerative farmers. So one of the things I'll point your listeners to is Regeneration International. If you click on their farm map and go to where you live, they have regenerative farms all over the world. Find your nearest one, send them an email, call them, go visit it. And you'll start to hear from these farmers. They'll talk about their land and their connection with it in almost a spiritual way. And so I think that's a, you'll connect with that farmer, start supporting them with your dollars and community action of some type. But it really kind of has to be on a local level that I find is where we've had the most wins. We're still fighting for a farm bill, but, you know, it's a lot tougher.
Your story about Hawaii makes me a little sad and a tiny bit angry, because in my mind, in the way I think and work, they would never have gotten past the beach, these chemical people. You know, talk about a pristine environment. I think they should have been fought off and sent home in damaged ships.
Yeah, it is shocking to see corn there. And it's almost like the chemical companies want to have our whole world just be corn, right? One of the places I went was the Amazon, and when I was at Amazon in Brazil, and I'm driving up the soybean highway, which is what it's called, from the Cargill port, and I like, this farm with its grain bins and tractors and its field of corn, this could be my neighbor. This looks like my neighbor's house, but I am not in Indiana. I'm in the middle of what once was the Amazon, now the edge of the Amazon, that has become a monoculture, which is just, it is shocking. And it's almost like the story of good and evil. I don't really state that so bluntly in the book, and I'm hoping that your readers can read it and see for themselves. But if an agrochemical company is suing this county of Kauai to spray chemicals near their schools, like what else would do we call that? And it's having major health consequences. I mean, many of us in the Midwest, are, and if you live near industrial agriculture, you suffer those consequences. My family certainly has, and you go to a funeral of a young farmer who died of cancer, and you hear the whispers. And so people are starting to wake up. I'm hoping, Mike, that people are starting to wake up that we cannot live short-term and long-term treating our world and treating each other like this.
And maybe we only need a small percentage more people feeling like that to make a wave. The wave will turn the battleship faster than you can.
Yeah, I mean, in my community, we fought off a hog CAFO that was going to be near the Mississinawa. We fought off a metal recycling plant that sounds great, but it wasn't because of what it pollutes in the air. And 1,000 people showed up at the courthouse. And this is just my community. So there are efforts in all of our communities that we can be a part of to make a difference. It's that local action that can have national and global repercussions. I think that's the best way. And I just really appreciate the work that you do through this show, Mike, to kind of evangelize that perspective and create more converts to this. Because, you know, for me, I was not wholly converted to thinking like this. I grew up around just corn and soybeans. I just thought that's the way the world was until I started to ask questions and have mentors who could teach me otherwise.
Hey, I didn't get woke till I was like 27, 28.
And what led to that?
A woman.
Oh, there you go. Well, that's what we need. That's the answer, Mike. A woman to lead us in the right direction.
Who insisted that if we were going to be a couple, we would move out to the country and I would grow her raspberries.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's great. Yeah, that's what we need. I mean, I got some raspberries that need picked right now.
Oh, yeah. You and I could go on forever, but we're not allowed to. But thank you. I have had a wonderful time talking with you. The wonderful time has been had talking to Kelsey Timmerman, author of the new book, Regenerating Earth, Farmers Working with Nature to Feed Our Future, just out from Patagonia Publishing. Kelsey, thank you for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. It's been awesome.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and recount a very happy personal observation. On June 23rd of this year, I spotted a lightning bug. And then I let my eyes get accustomed to the dark and saw hundreds in the trees and gardens. I guess that soakingly wet spring I endured was good for something after all. But don't you go firefly spotting just yet, because we'll be right back with an update on those dreaded lanternflies and more of your dreaded phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. What can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me. As long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls. Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in just a little bit, excellent good news about the spotted lanternfly. But first, one of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, great to hear you.
Great to hear you, David. How are you?
I'm doing well.
And where is David doing well?
I'm in Clarksville, Tennessee.
Okay, very good. What can we do you for?
Well, I've got the standard early and late blight with the tomato plants. And I heard somewhere that if you use pine straw underneath the plants, you can prevent the soil from bouncing up onto the leaves with a heavy rainfall. And for the most part, it's worked very well. My main question, though, is what do I do with the pine straw at the end of the season? And what do I do with the plants themselves at the end of the season? I've been discarding both of them for fear of continuing the blight in the garden. But I'm wondering if I'm doing the right thing.
So just general advice for everybody else out there. If you see that happening on your plants, and it's not severe, pull off every affected leaf, even if you're taking off half the leaves, and throw them in the trash. Believe it or not, I have had success growing tomatoes out past a mild case of late blight. You know, there is a tomato, I believe it's called Mountain, and similar tomatoes that has some resistance to the blight. So you might want to look into that. I like your idea of the straw mulch. It is smart to try to stop the rain from splashing back up, but it's also a great cooling mulch that keeps weeds down, but really keeps the airflow going. Now, do you do the same thing with your potatoes once they come up out of the ground?
I usually just continue to mound up the hills so that the leaves stay mostly above the ground, but I don't particularly mulch them, no. By that time, I've usually run out of pine straw.
Well, first of all, you know, tomatoes are supposed to be planted deep as the roots will allow you to go. And I would suggest strongly that you just get more straw and you will avoid problems. Now, after the fact, if the plants did show signs of disease, you want to put them in the trash. Do not compost them. However, if you wish to use the leftover straw as the brown ingredient in your compost system, that would be perfectly acceptable, especially if you make it hot compost, which would be all your straw mulch and about 10 gallons of spent coffee grounds mixed together. That puppy will heat up and it'll kill the disease organisms.
Even if some of the yellow disease blighted leaves happen to fall down into the pine mulch,
the
heat from the compost will, well, as best I can, I would like to, but I'm just afraid occasionally there may be some.
Everything in life should come with as best I can, you know.
I agree.
So that's, of course, as best you can. And then if you think they're harboring disease, I would still encourage you to build a hot compost system and to make compost hot. Do you have a compost pile or bin or anything like that?
I have some cement blocks that I made into a horseshoe for my rough stuff.
Right.
And then I feed that into my tumbler that I can add to and rotate as I need.
So what I want you to do with your rough stuff is make sure there's a lot of dry brown material, again, like the straw, and there is a lot of high nitrogen material, which could be poultry manure or spent coffee grounds. I mean, there's a lot of coffee shops in your area, and they'd be happy to save you grounds for the garden. But before you build up the pile, drive a stake into the ground in the center, and then make a tube about the width of your arm or leg out of just basic chicken wire and drop that over the stake and then build up your material around that. If you do it correctly, you'll be able to go out on a nice fall day afterwards, hold your hands over that chimney and feel the warmth.
Wow. Well, I do have a supply of chicken manure.
Well, you know, that is one of the highest natural sources of nitrogen, so it seems like you got all you need.
All right.
All right. Well, good luck to you, sir.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling Lanternfly Season is Here. Are you prepared? So, the question we're going to answer is from 5 years ago, but you'll be able to figure out why we're doing this in a little bit. So, 5 years ago, Nancy in Flowertown, PA wrote, "I found a colony of tiny black bugs with white dots on my roses. I instinctively squashed them with a gloved hand, but did not think to get a picture first and could not ID them on Google. I'm hoping they weren't beneficial. Can you help me with this?" Yes, I can, and I think an update about this pest is long overdue. Those crazy black and white cartoon dice with legs are the nymph form of the invasive spotted lanternfly. And those funny-looking dots soon turn into monstrous invaders that we must stop from progressing into their adult form. On individual plants, you can spray them off with sharp, and I mean sharp, streams of water, or saturate them with insecticidal soap or a light horticultural oil designed to be used in the summer. Remember, soaps and oils only work when you spray the pests directly and smother them. There is no residual action. At that time, the Allentown Morning Call reported that if they do reach their colorful and annoying adult stage, a new trap had just been created that homeowners could either make or purchase. Spotted lanternfly circle traps, which can be bought online or made at home, are essentially wire mesh wrapped around the tree that guides the upward climbing young lanternflies into a bag or container where they get trapped and die. A circle trap offers homeowners an alternative to sticky tape, which has come under deserved fire for also catching birds and mammals. The circle trap gets us away from that sticky material, explained Heather Leach, an extension associate at Penn State, so you can use it without fear of harming birds or bats. The lanternflies damage plants by feeding on them and by excreting a sticky, sweet substance called honeydew that attracts ants like mad. They cause damage to trees, especially Tree of Heaven, their favorite host, as well as grapes, apples, hops, stone fruit, and other plants. McGrath here. In my experience, they do the worst damage on grapevines, leading to scarily massive pesticide use that it turns out isn't even very effective. Now, people can make their own circle traps with household items. You'll find details at the Penn State Extension website, and we'll include a direct link to those directions in the written version of this question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. The traps are effective because lanternfly nymphs, young lanternflies without the signature pink and brown spotted wings, typically feed on the upper parts of trees, then they fall to the ground, and then they climb back up. It's almost like a minnow trap for spotted lanternfly. They don't try to get out, and they perish in the trap, explains Emily Swackhammer, a Penn State Extension educator. The trap works best on the nymphs, so don't delay if you want to get the best results from this. Swackhammer prefers trap designs that lead the lanternflies into plastic bags, which you can then collect, throw out, and replace. That way you don't have to empty out the dead insects, which, quote, get really smelly. And now, as promised, a very recent update reported by one of my former stations, the mighty WHYY in Philadelphia. And we quote, when the lanternfly first appeared, scientists worried that it had no natural predators. But a decade since its arrival, researchers are discovering that more and more native species are munching on the bug. Penn State Professor of Entomology Kelly Hoover did a citizen science survey to see if anything was actually eating them. And they were. We had almost 2,000 reports of animals feeding on spotted lanternflies, says Hoover, adding that it was incredible how many different species. We got reports of arthropods, spiders, ants, and lots of other insects and many birds. Many different types of birds are reported to be feeding on them. Some people also reported seeing raccoons, chipmunks, frogs, and even fish eat lanternflies on occasion. What Hoover also discovered is when lanternflies don't feed on their preferred tree, the Tree of Heaven, they seem more desirous to vertebrates like birds. Animals will feed on lanternfly that have munched on the Tree of Heaven's sap, but they much prefer those that don't. On the other hand, arthropods, spiders, ants, praying mantis, really don't seem to care what the spotted lanternfly was eating. Our star predator is something called the spined soldier bug, says Hoover. They dig their beaks into the pests and suck all the juices out. A note from me again, spined soldier bugs do resemble stink bugs, so look up the differences and think twice before you squish. Hoover also found increasing number of eggs from the Carolina mantis, the Chinese mantis, and wheel bugs in areas of heavy lanternfly infestation. When the lanternflies start hatching, those predators go right after them. Hoover's current research is honing in on what seems to be their biggest predator, that spine soldier bug. She asked, do the bugs increase their rate of predation when the lanternfly populations increase? If so, those bugs could be key to controlling the spotted lanternfly population naturally. They could be released to help control the lanternflies in vineyards, for instance. And vineyards are the most vulnerable to lanternfly infestations and have suffered the most economic damage, says Flor Acevedo, assistant professor of entomology at Penn State. By the way, the most resilient vine, the one that lanternflies do not do well after eating, is the native muscadine grape. Remember when we had the brown marmorated stink bug come into Pennsylvania, and it was a serious problem for many, many years, Hoover recalls? But after about 10 years, natural enemies were feeding on them, and now they're pretty well managed. That sure was some hopefully helpful information about all of our beneficial friends who eat lanternflies now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to turn on my lanternflies if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. That's 610-694-8100. And follow the prompts to You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. No matter how you contact us, please include your location. And please visit our Facebook page, where we constantly post new photos of stuff that looks good in my garden, important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive question of the week, and links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he was bitten by a radioactive spider while being doused with a cabinet full of chemicals that had just been struck by lightning. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprode. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. Special thanks to today's guest, Kelsey Timmerman, author of the new book, Regenerating Earth, Farmers Working with Nature to Feed Our Future, just out from Patagonia Publishing, and we had more of that interview than we could fit. So if you want to hear the entire thing, just tune in to our priceless podcast. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be keeping an eye on my garden so I can harvest each bulb at just the right stage, because we pick no garlic before it's time. But I'll stop long enough to see you again next week.
Yeah.